You're listening to EFT Radio Online, where we explore meridian tapping techniques for self-help and peak performance. By listening to this audio, you agree to the disclaimer located at eftradioonline.com/disclaimer. If you'd like to get the schedule of all the upcoming EFT radio shows and access to archive shows, please visit us at eftradioonline.com, where you can subscribe to our free newsletter.
Thank you for joining Change Your Mind Transformational Dialogue Radio. Your host, Dr. Craig Wiener, brings you cutting-edge experts and paradigm shifters in fields as diverse as body-mind healing, neuroscience, and consciousness explorations. Join us on this voyage to explore new worlds in science and transformational pathways. Seek out new understanding and boldly go where few have gone before.
Well, welcome back to Change Your Mind Transformational Dialogue Radio. This is Dr. Craig Wiener, and again, one more time, I am just honored and privileged to have a very special guest, and I always mean it, and it's always true, but this time especially so. This is a day that I'll get to speak with Dr. Larry Dossey, and for the one or two of you out there that have never heard of Dr. Dossey, which is hard to do, Larry Dossey is a preeminent figure in the field of mind, body, and beyond medicine. Dr. Dossey was an internist for many, many years. Before that, he was a pharmacist, and after that, he has come to be just a preeminent figure in the field as an author, as a lecturer, as a teacher, as an editor. He edits Explore Journal. He's been involved in the field of mind-body medicine as it relates to politics and working with Hillary Clinton's task force. His books are extensive, Healing Words, and currently we're going to be speaking about the power of premonition, but also One Mind, Healing Beyond the Body, Reinventing Medicine, Prayer is Good Medicine. So the books go on, and as I've read and followed his work, there seems to be, I don't know how he has the possible time to be teaching and writing and collecting the amount of data and information and synthesizing and bring it together in such a poetic way that there really are very few like him. So without any further ado, I'd like to just welcome and say hi to Dr. Larry Dossey.
Well, Craig, it's really a delight to be on your program. I really appreciate the invitation.
And you're very, very welcome. You know, the show and what I try to do here is to bring paradigm-shifting people that are at the cutting edge of transforming how we live our lives that can be made very personal. And your work exemplifies that, how we can bring science and things beyond that which we understand into the personal to change our lives. And so I would just like to start off with knowing for you, what is your motivation with the work that you do as you explore the fields of prayer, the fields of mind-body medicine, the fields of premonition? What is really your calling to bringing that work forth for people? I'm curious.
Well, it started out as a personal journey, and I think if our journeys amount to anything, if they're worth the telling, they have to be personal. Otherwise, they seem sort of hollow and empty. I began to become intrigued with the role that consciousness plays in health because, as in many instances, it had to do with a personal illness. Back in grade school, I began to have classical migraine headaches. These were so severe that they sort of crescendoed as I went along in my educational career. By the time I got to medical school, they were really absolutely horrendous. It wasn't just a headache, though. The worst thing was partial blindness. I actually tried to drop out of medical school because I thought it was an ethical issue. I figured it was just a matter of time until I had one of these episodes of partial blindness in a critical situation and might injure or even kill someone. Nothing worked for me. I tried every conceivable medication on the market at the time with no results. And then in the early 70s, something amazing happened for me. Biofeedback erupted on the national scene. And it was reported that people who learned biofeedback, if they had migraine headache syndrome, the migraine often went completely away. I was desperate at the time, and I chased all over the country learning how biofeedback, and it was almost a miraculous thing. Almost overnight, within just a few sessions of learning biofeedback, the whole thing went away to the tune of about 99%, I'd say. And I was hooked on the role of consciousness, the use of imagery, visualization, relaxation, and meditation in health outcomes. I never gave that up. It continued to be a fascination for me. I followed that interest into the research surrounding distant healing and prayer and the nature of consciousness and what that implied for our origins and our destiny. So that's kind of a short version of how I got here.
Perfect. And it's been my observation as well that the personal and what we go through as individuals influences our work and our passions and our missions. So now I'm curious, here you are an internist in Texas with perhaps a perspective that's rather unique amongst other allopathic physicians, and yet you've had this personal experience. What was it like to pursue that path? Did you have to keep it secretive? Did you share it just among certain peers? I imagine that there had to be a challenge about that in the 70s, 80s.
Well, there was a severe challenge about that. I was a founder of a medical group in Dallas. It proved to be it grew to be the largest internal medicine group in the city. There were, out of the dozens of my colleagues, maybe one or two who really understood what I was up to with focusing on consciousness, imagery, visualization, and all of that kind of thing. And the rest were either completely oblivious to it, without any interest in at all, and there were a few who were downright hostile. It was a balancing act. I had ammunition on my side because I was familiar with all the research which pointed to the effect of these interventions, so I wasn't troubled by that. And I was chief of staff for quite a while of this huge hospital in Dallas, so I could will my authority, so to speak, and stand up for these sorts of issues. But I'm sure that you know how this goes. There's sometimes a whispering campaign about these crazy things that we are doing and how we're trying to take medicine back to the dark ages, this sort of thing. And that still continues to this day. But I'm sure you know, having been in the trenches as well for quite a while, that it's never been easier than it is currently because things really have changed tremendously. I remember back in the 70s that people who went into health food stores were called health nuts. You know, all those pejorative phrases that just practically don't exist any longer because it's just sort of in our cultural DNA that it's okay to do that now. Well, it wasn't okay.
I actually want to pause, and I want to acknowledge and thank you because you really are one of the reasons that, amongst many others and many other forces. So I don't want to get too much to your head, but yet you've been a very key player in bringing that balancing act of bringing the science forth, so that the person that's speaking, the average chiropractor, the average massage therapist, the other people that are speaking to their medical doctors, they can't just say, oh, that's just your opinion. And you've been able to provide a wealth of literature that's combined to say, well, it's not just my opinion.
Well, I think that's been key. Craig, that in this business of medicine, which we say rests on science, you don't get very far on anecdote and, you know, saying, trust me. And the nice thing about this evolution is that we have seen the science progress. We have a ton of information and ammunition on our side, and so that's not going away. It just simply gets better and better and stronger and stronger. I often hear young physicians lament these days about how tough it is to stand up for the things that they believe in, and I often say, look, guys, you should have been around in the 70s. It's never been easier than now, you know. Don't complain so much. I recall. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, really, the small cadre, but I imagine that's growing, of the people that stand out, you know, places like Ryan and the Pear Institute and SRI and HeartMath and Dean Radin at IONS. Mm-hmm. you know, that cadre of people that all, I'm sure, know each other very well and have commiserated, but are really continuing to provide this level. But now it seems even more that there's this bigger circle, especially with a lot of the mindfulness-based meditation studies, and there seems to be a much larger interest that's happening. Do you find that?
Yeah, I'll just give you one example. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, when acupuncture first came on the scene, it was laughable. You know, doctors made jokes about how you relieve pain by causing pain by sticking needles in people. Isn't that silly? Now, every first-rate pain clinic and every major medical school and university in the country has an acupuncturist or two on the staff in the pain management area. So this has gone from being something that people made a joke out of to something that is entirely mainstream. Acupuncture is one of the most interesting examples we have about the evolution of mind-body medicine across the past three or four decades.
I totally agree. Being also a chiropractor and practitioner of EFT that bases many of its principles on the use of meridian acupuncture points, I've seen the power of it very personally as well as a recipient of acupuncture.
Yeah.
But now we're stretching it with your newer book, The Power of Premonition, in a little different direction. Or, mm-hmm. you know, one beautiful thing that you do is you keep pushing that edge of consciousness from prayer studies, which many would have said, you know, okay, now we're outside of science,
yeah.
right? And you really help to integrate those two and do a beautiful job. I use that often. But now with The Power of Premonition, now we're starting to address some of the psi research and some aspects of the linearity of time, of the ability to affect the past and present, of the ability to perceive distances from afar. So did that take kind of a deep breath before you decided to go there, or is it just old hat, this is just what you do now?
A very deep breath. I actually tried not to write this book. I thought, you know, the prayer stuff is controversial enough. Why in the world do I need to go in this direction of premonitions? But I thought that I really did need to go in this direction because it really is an extension of the areas of spirituality and prayer and so on that I've been working on for some time. And the connection, Craig, is that consciousness, whether we look at it through prayer or healing intentions at a distance or through premonition, says this. There's something about our consciousness that is extended in space and in time, and these things seem to go together. That's not surprising if we take Einstein seriously, because he taught us about the space-time continuum. So if I'm going to talk about how consciousness operates at a distance in space, I better get ready to be ready to see it operating outside the present moment, extended in time as well. And that's what premonitions are all about. They are a way of sensing something before it happens. It's a way of acquiring information from the future. And what's important also with respect to health is that these things often impact our health, because they often give us warnings of threats to our physical existence, of upcoming illnesses, things that if we were aware of them, we might avoid and be healthier and perhaps remain alive even. So there's really a very strong tie-in between this book on premonitions and the previous books on the ability of consciousness to operate at a distance through healing intentions in prayer.
So let me ask you this now. As much as you've had to explore in your mind and in reading every aspect of this, how do you personally come to now see, is there a preordained future? Is there one that, like genetics, is a blueprint of the possibilities of the future? What is it that we're reading, and how can we alter it? That idea of predestined mm-hmm. possibilities versus what we're doing to affect and change. So I'm kind of curious how you perceive that now, how that fluidity.
Well, this question always comes up when people think about seeing the future. Some of them despair about this. They don't want to know what the future is because they say, it's locked in, and why, you know, it's going to happen anyway, so why do I want to know about it ahead of time? There's nothing I could do to change it. Mm-hmm. This is the view that our future is written in stone, and there's nothing practical about having a premonition since you can't do anything about it anyway. And I think this view is just completely false. I think that the future that we see in a premonition is not fixed. It's not written in stone. There are many physicists and theoreticians these days who talk about what they call a probable future. The future we glimpse in a premonition is not fixed. It's statistically less or more likely. It's not something that's inevitable. And if you actually look at the experiences people have in premonitions, you see that they do glimpse things that often do happen, but they can change part of it so that their life is spared. The life of a loved one may be secured and spared as well. Can I give you an example to
Please.
Sort of take the mystery out of this? I start the book on premonitions with the experience of a young woman, a young mother in Washington State. Her account is on file at the Ryan Institute. And she had a dream one night in which she saw the chandelier, which was above her infant's crib in the room next to her and her husband's bedroom. She saw in this premonition dream the chandelier fall and wreck the crib and kill the baby. This was a nightmare. She woke up in a frenzy. She woke her husband and told him about the dream. He said, "It's just a dream. Go back to sleep," which he promptly did. So she could not go back to sleep. She got up and went and got the baby out of the crib and brought it back to bed with them, and they all nestled in and went back to sleep. A couple of hours later, she heard a loud noise in the baby's room. She went in with her husband, and the chandelier had actually fallen out of the ceiling exactly as she had dreamed and had just demolished the crib. If the baby had remained in the crib, the baby almost certainly would be dead. Oddly, in her dream, originally, she saw a clock in the baby's room that read 4:35 in the morning. And then when she went in and saw what had happened, the chandelier had fallen, she saw the clock on the baby's bureau, and it read 4:35. So the event which she saw in her dream came true partially. The chandelier did fall. It did demolish the crib. But because she took action, she actually changed part of that future by taking the baby back to the bed and rescuing it. So this is an example of the fact that the future can stay pretty much the same, but we can take action to avoid some of the calamities that are part of that future. And I like this because it also shows how these things can play a huge role in our lives. It can actually be a matter of life and death.
That's a perfect example. I liked in your book also, because that one is an extreme, but yet the University of Chicago study said that up to 67% of Americans have had some sort of premonition, precognitive type experience, which is a majority of us.
Well, yeah. You know, the skeptics are fond of saying that these things are just kind of rare. You know, they should be ignored because you just cherry pick and all of this sort of thing, and they aren't common. But that's just false. Surveys show, and they've consistently shown this for decades, that these things are so common, the majority of Americans at some time in their life will have one of these things that just sort of knocks your socks off.
Right. Now, you were saying before that some people maybe are a little bit overwhelmed or don't want to know because they can't affect it. Now, in your book, and I would agree with you, that you stated that there's an inherent, almost an innate ability to have this kind of first sight, or what some people would say second sight, being able to have this ability to see more than quote-unquote reality. And yet some things that we may do may repress or inhibit that ability, and maybe that's recoverable or maybe not. Could you speak to that sense of that it's a beyond one of our five senses that we may be able to influence or support or repress?
I think this is hardwired in pretty much everybody. And the reason I believe it is because it contributes what biologists call a survival value for us. If we know what the dangers lie ahead, we may be able to avert them, as Amanda did with the baby and the chandelier. And evolutionary biologists tell us that if a trait develops that contributes toward saving our life, then we will be around to propagate and perpetuate our genetic structure. So these are the sorts of traits that get genetically programmed in human beings across millions of years of evolution. I think it's likely that because these things do contribute to our survival, that they have become innate. They become probably unconscious. They are so deeply embedded in our genetic structure that they function at an unconscious level, for example, through dreams, and they keep us out of trouble a lot of times. I was a battalion surgeon in Vietnam in 68-69, and I knew a lot of young men who said, Doc, the reason I'm still alive is that because I just sort of have a hunch about when something bad's going to happen. And it was an example to me early on that what we call hunches or intuition is probably no more than premonition come to life. And so I think these things really are very, very common and operate in a way which just doesn't leap out and say, look, the premonition's happening. We just sort of deal with these fairly gracefully. We call them intuition, hunches, vibes, or whatnot. There are ways that we can, I think, enhance what premonition ability is innate in us. And the studies that have been done show that if people follow some sort of meditation discipline and are really regular with it and dedicated discipline toward it, premonitions occur more frequently in people who do that. I think the reason that is so, Craig, is because meditation has a way of freeing up the unconscious so that things that we ordinarily would not be aware of float to the level of awareness and we just simply notice them more. Also, people who keep a dream diary, when they wake up every morning, they either write down or talk their dreams into a tape recorder or some way to record them. This has a way of freeing up premonitions during one's dream life. Dream premonitions become more likely when people do that. And I think it's just another way of encouraging our unconscious to declare itself in a way that becomes more noticeable. So although we all have an innate ability to some degree, I think that this is really pronounced in some people to a greater degree. There are prodigies with premonitions, just like there are prodigies in any other area of human endeavor, such as art or music, math, athletics, and so on.
And in the book you spoke to, I don't want to necessarily refer to personality types, but certain aspects of people, whether it be about belief in certain things, whether it be about certain ways of being in the world. Could you speak to maybe who might be somebody that might be more apt to or more readily apt to receive premonitions?
In the book, I talk about a lot of personality traits that make people more or less premonition prone. And certainly people who are extroverted tend to be more open to this sort of thing. People who have a high level of intuition, as judged by certain personality tests like the Myers-Briggs type inventory, people who score high on intuition are more premonition prone. A lot of other factors come into play, like belief in the transcendent, an attitude that makes you open toward disorganization and chaos and the unpredictable in your life. All of these factors can come together and create a type of personality that is just simply more premonition prone than other people. But I think the main thing to understand is that destiny is not fixed. We can shape through personal behaviors and disciplines an ability to be more premonition prone if that's the direction we want to go in. And I emphasize that matter of choice because I've met a few people in life who just really don't want to have anything to do with this, as we were talking about a moment ago. And I think people just need to look into their hearts and decide if this is something that they feel comfortable with and want to be a part of who they are and make that a part of their worldview. And if that's so, then there's meditation and keeping dream diaries and that sort of thing.
You also mentioned the possibility that I wouldn't recommend things like epilepsy and head trauma as being at least case studies that have shown pre-premonition traumas that have perhaps somehow shaken things up to be able to allow that information to come through easier.
Well, that's true, and this fascinates me. There are innumerable cases in the neurology literature where head trauma has preceded the ability to have premonitions, and I don't know how that works. I don't think anybody else does either, but I think we have to bear in mind that this idea of neuroplasticity is very real, and brains just simply aren't fixed. You know, there are pathways that can be enhanced. There are some that can be de-enhanced. And the plain fact is that sometimes trauma, head trauma, does precede the ability to have vivid premonitions.
I'm personally fascinated and can't get enough of understanding and exploring the field of neuroplasticity, especially with the kind of technology that we have now, being able to see and visualize the brain in different capacities. So I have another question that really looks at kind of right versus left brain issues. And when we start to look at people that tend to be more right brain activated, that tend to seek meaning and tend to look at things more or more open to getting information through images and through feelings. And can you speak a little bit about that and anything that you've been seeing in the literature with regard to that?
Well, I really want to line up with you on that point of view, because people who live in their left brains, who are dedicated to reason, logic, analysis, and so on, really seem to be fighting an uphill battle about opening up to premonitions and that sort of thing. As I said a moment ago, people who are at home with disorder and chaos, which instantly brings up people like artists and, you know, certain musicians and things like that, people who really are at home with a right brain kind of nonlinear knowing and experience are people who just are open to premonitions. And I don't know if it's because they actually have more frequent premonitions than people who live in their left brains, or if they're just simply open to recognizing them when they happen. I'm not sure which way that goes. But it's certainly a fact that people who are at home with more disorder, nonlinear thinking, and chaos in their lives, and unpredictability, i.e. right-brain-oriented individuals, tend to be more gifted toward experiencing premonitions than the reverse.
Makes total sense to me. It starts to bring up, when we bridge that gap between thought, images, intuition, and neuroanatomy, that we've become very fixed by the physical senses of taste and smell and auditory, et cetera. And suddenly there seems to be this emergence of possibilities anatomically, maybe, that we haven't yet discovered, that we do have ways of receiving information beyond those physical senses.
And I think there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
You know, the whole world of parapsychology concerns itself with that the possibility that you just raised, which is that there are ways of acquiring information that bypass sensory mechanisms of see, touch, feel, hear, and so on. This is simply a fact. I believe that we are in an era where we as a culture, as a society, are becoming more open to this possibility. The amount of evidence is, I think, overwhelming that we have the ability to acquire information from a great distance without the mediation of the physical senses. And even more than that, we have the ability to insert information into the environment at a great distance without any mediation by the physical senses. My friend and your friend, Stephen Schwartz, is publishing a couple of papers currently which shows the statistical evidence favoring this sort of thing, the ability to know and to make a difference in the environment without any kind of sensory intervention whatsoever. the odds are staggering, favoring this possibility. And I'm talking about something on the order of billions and trillions against chance that this is in fact happening. It's just a shame that we in science have turned a blind eye to this sort of thing, because in doing that, we have underestimated our abilities as human beings. We've undersold what we're capable of. And I think that this is where we really do need to open up, because if we can say, look, we're more than we thought, the implications for immortality, for some temporally infinite aspect of our psyche is very real. This would unload us of a tremendous burden of fear of the annihilation of all that we are with physical death. There's something more that goes beyond time.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I beg your pardon?
Continue, I'm sorry.
Well, I think that this is where the game really gets very interesting, because we're touching here, when we say that we can act outside the future, we're touching on the issue of survival of bodily death, because we have identified an aspect of who we are that is outside of time, that's not confined to the present. It clearly is not confined to the physical constraints of the brain and body. And so what is this? Well, I think that if you reason through all of this, you come out at a place where you say this begins to look suspiciously like what we've always called the soul or spirit, something that transcends the physical body in the present moment. And this is where I think the gold, the real treasure, and all of this sort of information really lies. It's about whether or not death is final, whether or not we're all physical, whether or not we're bound up to the brain and body, or whether there's something more. I think all this information you and I are discussing points like an arrow to the fact that we're more than our brain and body. We're not confined to the present. And so this shifts the existential premises of what it means to be human.
Beautifully said. I was going to say the ability then for us to determine reality is often based on what people have said, well, if I can see it or feel it or touch it, then it's real, and anything beyond that is not. And that somewhat begins to speak to what you're saying, and yet there's also the whole idea of that which is observed is real, and that which is not observed may not become real until it's observed. So how do we balance that idea between what we observe is real, and yet, at the same time, there's so much beyond what we can sense or know?
Well, that's a fabulous question, and I think it's the journey of our lifetime to learn to be comfortable with both of those ways of being in the world. I think that we are dual creatures. We live in a see-touch-feel world, and I think that's just terrific for our survival. It helps us stay alive and procreate and so on. But if we deny the other side of who we are, that ability to know and comprehend without mediation by the physical senses, if we deny that part of us, we're just shutting down a crucial part of who we are. We're what have been called bifid creatures, dual creatures. We live in two different worlds. And I think that it's just fine to do that. I mean, I think that makes us more likely to evolve as a species and endure. But also, simply to confine ourselves, as we have done through the physical sciences and biology and so on for the past 200 or 300 years, and say that that's all we are. We're only physical creatures who only know something through observation, see, touch, feel, and so on. It's short-circuiting who we are. I think that probably our fate on Earth and our survival as a species depends hugely on our ability to open up to this other side of who we are, the spiritual side, the psychological side, that goes beyond simply being an embodied creature.
I see that, number one, is absolutely correct. I also see the challenges with that. For example, in healthcare, to me, it seems on one hand, if we enhance our abilities and the the paradigm that, quote unquote, we have greater ability to heal ourselves or heal others. Number one, we're going to have quite a few healthcare industries that are not going to necessarily appreciate that from a profit standpoint. And also, it creates this duality of, I'm sure you've seen many of the studies show majorities of physicians believe in the spiritual side, but it's almost like they can't be open about that. It's almost as if there's a behind-the-curtain conversation that's happening,
yeah,
and one that's out in front, and there's not an arena that we can explore science and spirituality and bring it together and get to the table with, okay, well, what's Big Pharma going to do if we actually start to enhance our self-healing capabilities? There are some real inherent challenges in this shift.
Well, you can say that again. I think you and I personally as physicians have known that those challenges are very real. They take the form of denial and that this other side exists, and that's something that we have to contend with. But there's good news also. I'll just give you one example. When I wrote a book called Healing Words, which dealt with the role of prayer in scientific research and in clinical practice, back in 1993, there were only three of the nation's medical schools that had any formal coursework looking at the role of spirituality in healthcare. And as we now speak, there are around 90 of those 125 medical schools that have actual courses looking at the role of spirituality in health outcomes. So we are making progress, and while it is still true that a lot of doctors are really uncomfortable going public with this sort of talk, it's getting better. You know, one reason it is that we now know on the basis of solid statistical evidence that people who do follow some sort of spiritual path in their life live 7 to 9 years longer than people who do not. And, Craig, this is just huge. You know, if you advise patients,
I think even quitting smoking doesn't extend.
Well, that's what I was going to add. If you were to get your patients to stop smoking, you could not assure them that they're going to add 7 to 9 or 10 years onto their life. So the gain of being spiritual, as far as longevity is concerned, is a heck of a lot longer than it is in stopping smoking. That's the level of importance that these issues have. You know, where the rubber meets the road, how long you live and how healthy you are in the process. So that's one reason why it's become much more appropriate to speak about these issues at the level of medical schools and academia.
That's perfect. I'm always moved and dumbfounded in reading your books and similar ones that compile not just the things that I believe in that we're speaking of so strongly, but the research that backs them up that is so strong. You know, when we start to work with really uncomfortable subjects like the ability to see or know the future and to know things that we shouldn't be able to, so to speak, you know, like Dean Radin's presentiment experiments.
Yeah.
Those are fabulous, that somehow our nervous systems are knowing things that are about to happen before they happen, points to the extraordinary skills and possibilities that we are as human beings.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Dean Radin. He's obviously one of the great pioneers in this field, and these presentiment studies I'd really champion because they have so much to do with premonition. Dean's studies show that there's some aspect of who we are that's unconscious that can apprehend what's going to happen in the future, and our body will respond to it even before it takes place. So Dean and I have become really close and talking about the connection between premonitions and what he's doing with these presentiment experiments. So we're having a great time putting all this stuff together these days. I never predicted.
I imagine the two of you in a room really just being able to have the kind of conversation that I'd love to be privy to, because there's a permission to have an unlimited conversation.
Well, can I tell you a little
Please?
Conversation that Dean and I did have I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. He's gone public with this, so I'm not talking out of turn here. I asked him how he comes up with all of these clever experiments that he does along these lines of presentiment and so on. And he said, "Oh, I dreamed them up," and I you know, laughed a bit and said, "Oh, isn't that cute?" I thought he was talking metaphorically, you know, I just dream them up. But he said, "No, they come to me in my dreams. I actually see the design of the experiments in dreams." And I thought, good grief. I mean, here's precognitive dreaming, which I'm working on, entering the structure of his research, and he does these things, and they come out being called presentiment, but there's this huge crossover and transition between both of these things. I don't think that we're probably talking about something entirely different here. It's the ability to know the future, whatever term we want to place on it. So this is the sort of thing, you know, that doesn't get written down in the papers when they're published in scientific literature, but, you know, when you have these hall conversations at meetings and so forth, these sorts of little goodies come out that I think are quite interesting and important.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I also love and appreciate some of the things that are written down, like your Einstein quote, that we have no right to rule out a priority, the possibility of telepathy. You know, how many people quote Einstein for that? I think that that's, you know, when we have preeminent thinkers, brilliant thinkers that are open enough beyond the science to see the possibility that exists beyond that which we know to date, are leaders and visionaries that help us point, and then we take a couple decades to catch up.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Einstein is an interesting example. You know, people associate Einstein with pure logic, analysis, mathematics, and so on, but there was this other side to him that was deeply, deeply irrational, and which actually courted things that were not entirely logical. There's one interview with Einstein in which people were asking him how he came up with his ideas, and he said that, well, he gets the insight first, and then later he dresses it up in mathematics. And, you know, people generally think of it the other way around. But if you look at the inner life and the working methods of a lot of some of the greatest scientists who have ever lived, you find that they often wing it with intuition, and then the analysis and logic come later. Some of them are absolutely overtly spiritual from the get-go and are public about it. There's a book called Quantum Questions written by Ken Wilber that goes into the spiritual beliefs of some of the world's great physicists and other types of scientists as well. So I think that is a collection that people who are interested in this field would do well to pay attention to, the book Quantum Questions.
I just made a note of that. I'm certainly familiar with Ken Wilber. Let me ask you, that then pushes for me the idea or the theory of the possibility of some sort of, you know, a la Greg Braden, Lynn McTaggart, and so many others that wrote and have worked with it on scientific levels of this field, okay, of this matrix, this field, this amorphous, spacious something that holds that, that is brilliance, is genius, the capacity to somehow tap that, that sphere of influence, that we can tap another's brilliance, that somehow we can borrow from memory, the thought, the future, the ideas of an Einstein, and that any person has the capability to tap something beyond just their 2.5 pounds of brain matter.
Well, I think that that's a very nice way of putting it, to call it the field. I have a term which I'm fond of. I call it non-local consciousness. Non-local is just a fancy word for infinite. If something's infinite in space, it's present everywhere. It's omnipresent. If something is infinite in time, it's at all moments, past, present, and future. So my favorite term for the field is non-local consciousness, non-local awareness, non-local mind. Actually, you give me an opportunity, Craig, to make a shameless advertisement for my next book, which is going to be published later this fall. It's called One Mind. The subtitle is How Our Individual Mind is Part of the Greater Consciousness and Why That Matters. So in this book, I, again, through a huge number of vignettes, talk about how our consciousness is just infinite in space and time, and I provide the scientific data that backs that up. So I agree with Lynn McTaggart and many others who are working in this field that you can't put consciousness in a box and separate it from all the other minds. It's out in the world. It's not localized. That's what we mean by saying it's non-local. You can't put boundaries or edges around it. It just doesn't work that way. And so we come out with a picture of who we are that's much more glorious and majestic than the one that you and I were taught about in professional school and university and college, and which our kids are still dragooned with when they go off to college. But we're going to win this debate because of one little simple reason, and that's called evidence. We have the evidence on our side, and although we may sometimes feel like we're swimming upstream now and promoting this point of view, we're going to win this war.
It is changing. I do see it, and I think it changes one reader at a time. One person that experiences it and gets validated, person at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And as that number grows, I remember being a brand new, right out of chiropractic school, and meeting with a rheumatologist and trying to build my practice and create relationships with other caregivers. And his perspectives on were unique. And I remember that when I spoke with him, I really understood that based on everything he heard and saw in medical school and experientially, why he had his points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very legitimate based on his experiences. So, and I bring that up just because as we have more and more experiences and as they get written up and as the literature shows it more, it becomes a tide that then influences even the strongest edifices within medicine and healthcare, I think. So it begins with the people.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. You know, there is this observation that a lot of people have made who study social change that before any big, huge shift happens in the worldview of a culture, right before that, the criticism and the obstruction becomes really vicious. And if you just pay attention to that, you just think that, you know, we're losing the ground we've gained. You know, we're losing this debate. But that's almost predictable, and I bump into that all the time. People who are just so dedicated to the old classical worldview that they want nothing to do with these ideas of non-local functioning of consciousness and things like presentiment and precognition, premonitions, and so on. I actually have a perverse little habit. I keep comments from skeptics, and I've got a whole file of these things. And my favorite is this. One guy said, it was a famous scientist, he said, talking about what you and I have been discussing here, he said, this is the sort of thing I wouldn't believe in, even if it were true, which just, you know, gives the whole show away. You know, we're not talking about, in this debate, always about evidence. We're talking about prejudice and bigotry and people who will not be moved by the evidence, no matter how powerful it is.
Well, that's perfect. What, as we start to wind down, first I do want to mention for people that would like more information on The Power of Premonitions, the book, as well as more information, your website, which is dossydossy.com, D-O-S-S-E-Y, and I'll let you explain why there's two Dossies in the URL there.
Well, my wife and I share this website, and so that's why there are two Dossies. I say she's the first Dossie, I'm the second one. But my wife, Barbara, is a nurse educator. She's written about 23 books on spirituality and nursing and the role of holistic approaches to nursing. She's a critical care nurse by profession and very well known in American nursing circles. So if there are nurses out there, healthcare professionals, who want to know more about nursing, her books are really seminal contributions in that field. And so you can follow us at our talks and lectures around the country and our schedule by resorting to the website.
That would be great. So I'd like to move toward your vision. I'd love to hear that. What things you see within maybe a vision for healthcare as in a larger architectural way, and also on a personal vision, if you could have your way accomplished within the next 2 decades, what might healthcare here in America and elsewhere as well look like?
Well, from purely a political, sociocultural standpoint, I favor universal single-payer healthcare system for our country, which happens to be the only major first world country without one. And I think that that's where we're going to wind up. I think nothing else financially and politically makes a whole lot of sense. What I think we're going to see and are already seeing is a kind of dual healthcare system in which we rightfully emphasize physical approaches such as surgery, better medications and so on that are used wisely. But alongside that, we're developing quite rapidly a way of affecting health outcomes through methods of conscious awareness and spirituality. The evidence is profound that these can make a difference in life and death. And the idea that we could just simply disregard these things, I think, is just absolute stupidity because of the evidence. And I keep coming back to that little word, data. The data compels us to make a place in healthcare in the future for interventions of consciousness and spirituality. That's going to be considered eventually as just simply good medicine. And I think that eventually it will become part and parcel of physically based medicine, so that in the far future we're not going to make a distinction between consciousness and spirituality-oriented practices and physically based practices. We'll just lump it all together and call it good medicine. That's where we're headed, and the sooner the better, I would say.
So do you see the role of physician taking back the role of educator? Because how is it that people will learn these consciousness studies? Is it going to be somehow within healthcare? Is it going to be an individual's responsibility, combination of both? How do you see that occurring?
Well, absolutely. You know, I think we're still going to see for some time to come that doctors are going to do what doctors are interested in more than anything. They'll continue to do that, and those are the physically based interventions such as drugs, use of drugs, medication, surgical procedures, and so on. And I'm okay with that. But what we will gradually see is a new kind of doctor who is open to combining spiritual / consciousness-oriented interventions with the physical. So that will be the doctor of the future. Now, in the interim, we will have a transitional stage, which we are developing now, which emphasizes, I think, non-physician interface with sick people. The best example I know this happening now is a movement called nurse coaching, which is just exploding across the country, in which nurses, by inherent interest and adaptability and interest, are much better at mediating consciousness and spiritually oriented practices than physicians are. I think that's going to be a teacher-based model. It's really gathering steam across the country. My wife is centrally involved with that movement, as a matter of fact. And other forms of teachers will also become involved as well. But you're right to emphasize that the root meaning of doctor is educator and teacher, and eventually I think we will reclaim that. I think it's going to take a while.
And if the doctors then start to reclaim some of their role as teacher, what needs to happen for people as patients, as recipients, as desiring to improve their health, the longevity? What kind of responsibility shifts do you think need to happen for us, for everybody?
Well, you're right to emphasize that, because we really are talking about a new form of client, a new form of patient as well, one who is open to the non-physical interventions. And I think that we will evolve together. I think that we can see this not by looking at what happens day to day in your and my medical practice, but if we take a back-off view and look at how things were about 30 or 40 years ago, we can see that there's a huge interest now that wasn't simply present back then of these non-physical interventions. There was a survey of about 75% of the nation's hospitals that was taken about 4 years ago, and people were asked after they got out of the hospital, what is it about modern hospital-based medicine that is in most need of improvement? And the thing that people mentioned most was spirituality. There's nothing spiritual about my experience. There's nothing warm. There's nothing meaningful about it. It was just all a matter of pure technical intervention. And it left me with the feeling that my needs had not been met. Well, that's where so many patients are, that expresses their need, their desire for meaning, and their desire for something beyond meddling with their bodies. So I think if we take a back-off look, we can see that we are, as a culture, as a society, evolving toward a form of medicine that honors the spiritual and psychological and so on, in addition to meeting the body's physical needs. So we're in the process. It never happens as fast as we want it to, but I think the direction is clear.
That's great. And I think you're right that education of our providers and the medical schools, the nursing schools, is key, because that's a significant influence, right? It takes, I think, you know, most doctors that I've met and spoken with on the subject, they begin with that kind of inundation of left brain material, because there's so much that needs to happen. But then through their experiences with patients and their experience with hitting the unknown and or their own injuries and experiences, they finally start to shift their way into a more integrative approach with their patients. But often they can be decades. And the first few decades where they were very a linear, not allowing for their own spirituality. And I think also that there's been this separation, that they didn't feel appropriate or comfortable bringing that personal side of themselves to their practice.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think a huge factor in the transition and evolution of doctors is their own suffering. I forget the number of the percentage of physicians across the nation who are now on antidepressants, but it's just huge. I mean, many people would think that that's just a curious, non-meaningful fact. I think it's absolutely profound, because we often evolve out of our own suffering, our own unmet needs. And I can tell you that it's not fun for a lot of doctors to be doctors anymore. And I know that you know that. But I think this is a huge factor in the evolution of American medicine. Joseph Campbell said once that we get smart by one of two methods. We can either have a sudden epiphany where we just have a breakthrough and it's spontaneous and unpredicted, or we can suffer. And he said suffering is the main reason humans get smarter. And I think we see that with physicians these days.
Yeah, there certainly is, you know, the adage, Dr. Heal himself. And that, I believe that's the same not just for physicians, whether it be somebody in the mental health or anything else, is starting to really create a healing for those people that are offering healing. I mean,
yes.
When we look at the expectations and we look at the stress, whether it be God, in medicine and the clergy and mental health providers, that the systems have created so much stress that somehow it's kind of like a parent saying, do what I do what I say, but not what I do.
Yep.
And there's a huge need for healing of the system and the practitioners that are within the systems.
That's right.
So I think that as we move toward the end of our hour, I just feel, again, great gratitude for the discussion and the opportunity.
It's been fun, Greg, and I would just suggest that we do it again sometime.
I would love that. It would be my joy. And you know, I started these transformational dialogues about 6 years ago, and I tell people it's really been a very selfish endeavor because it allows me the opportunity to have conversations with people that I've always wanted to, and then the secondary benefit is that I get to share it with others that are also interested. So,
well, that's a higher form of selfishness.
Thank you. So with that, I say again, a last plug for the Power of Premonitions, for any of your books, for your upcoming books, we'll be waiting that with bated breath. And the best way to find out more about courses and books and workshops is dossiedossie.com. And with that, I say thank you. Do you have a beautiful and wonderful day, and thank you so much for your contributions.
Right. It's been a joy, Craig. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. God bless.
Thank you for joining us today on Change Your Mind Radio. For more information on this program and more, go to www.transformationalpathways.com.